we have so much work and so much information to be given to you today that even though the Senate members have not arrived yet, Senate members, if you hear me, please come to committee. And what I want to do is just bring us together now and ask Robin Lamont to bring us up to date with the information and the other part of the agenda that you are going to be hearing today. I'm going to ask you something in advance, and that is that if you will write your questions down until the end of each presenter's presentation, I'd appreciate that because it allows them to go a little faster in doing what they're doing, and then we can answer questions at the close of each presenter's presentation. Thank you very much, Ms. Lamont.
Thank you, Madam Chair, co-chairs, and members of the committee. I'm Robin Lamont with the Legislative Fiscal Office. Doug Wilson and Sheila Baker from LFO are also here, and the I believe I saw the Judiciary Committee's Administrator Bill Taylor here too. We're here for the third biennial public safety system overview. For those of you who have attended prior overviews, you're going to note a significant change. We're not going to spend time looking at the PowerPoint presentation that details the system this time. We will provide that to you as a handout. Instead, what we're doing this time is to focus on an interactive skit. The first day we'll address dependency and delinquency issues. Day two we'll focus on adult and criminal issues. And we're going to attempt a multimedia presentation with representative slides that will flash up as the skits are occurring. Judge Jean Maurer from Multnomah Circuit Court will be the narrator. And at points during the skit, she will take a break.
Thank you so much, Judge.
At points during the skit, she'll take a break to discuss issues and answer any questions that you might have. Judge Kristen Thompson from Washington County Circuit Court will be the judge for the skit today. I would like to thank the judges for their participation and to thank everyone else who's volunteered to assist in this. For the most part, the people you'll see in the skits are employees of the actual state and local agencies that are involved in the relevant part of the public safety system. But I'd especially like to thank Nancy Cosine of the Oregon Judicial Department for all her work in drafting and redrafting and redrafting the skit, and Susan Grady of the Oregon State Bar for all of her efforts in preparing the accompanying slideshow. We have provided you with a copy of the key public safety system issues. Those of you who are on Ways and Means would have heard that presentation while you were hearing the overviews. Doug Wilson talked about them. They are in a handout on your desk. And issues include funding such as compensation for judges and public defenders, insufficient resources such as availability of treatment programs, and infrastructure, including safe and sufficient courthouses. The judge may reference some of these issues as the skit proceeds. And before I turn this over to Judge Maurer, I wanted to remind everybody that this skit will continue at 8:30 tomorrow morning. Again, a joint meeting of the committee. And with that, Judge?
All right, thank you. Good afternoon. Committee chairs and members of the committee. I didn't intend to introduce myself in that manner, but I hope it was memorable. I'm Jean Maurer, and I'm a judge in Multnomah County. I'm a circuit judge, a trial judge. And we are going to present, as you was indicated, a skit. And the reason that we are using a skit is that we hope it will demonstrate in an interesting way the degree to which the public safety system is connected. All the parts are connected. One way of looking at it, I think, is as an ecosystem. If one part is out of balance, another part is out of balance. Another way of looking at it, and it's just my age that takes me there, is that the thigh bone's connected to the hip bone. And so we want you to have a view of a very common circumstance in Oregon. This is going to be portrayed as an event that is unfortunately one that we are seeing all the time in the courts. And that's when a family is affected by methamphetamine. It could be any drug, but right now methamphetamine is the one that we're using. I want you to envision, if you can, a rainy day in Portland, not hard to imagine, or in an outlying rural area anywhere in Oregon. The police have some information. They have information from neighbors suggesting that there is a methamphetamine operation taking place at a house. They have information that children live in that house. This is a remote area of Portland, not readily accessible. There are roads there, but not buses. And so they want to get some information that will let them go in and make sure that everybody who is living in that house is safe. And because they know there are children living there, they now have a representative from DHS, Department of Human Services, and the Child Welfare Division to provide assistance to the children. We're trying to use some screens here. As you can see, this is a situation when the babe is made. When they go in, it is dangerous. Officers oftentimes have to be garbed, and yet children live in this environment because of the effects of methamphetamine. Living in this particular home are five people. There is the dad. And the dad is named Chris. He's 30 years old. Not surprisingly, Chris comes from a broken family. He has some convictions. He has a step one conviction. He has an assault conviction. He didn't complete high school. He works odd jobs. And he has used various illegal drugs since the time he was about 14 years of age. This is not an uncommon depiction of the effect of methamphetamine. We see this all the time. The mother who lives in this family is Sally Lewis. She is 33 years of age. And Sally, like her husband, comes from a broken family, troubled family history, has some prior convictions of her own. There are three children. Michael, who is 15 years of age. Michael is someone that, you have, not surprisingly again, has found himself starting to use methamphetamine. In addition to that, there are two little children. We have Jason, who is 5, and Justin, who is 2. The situation that confronts the officers upon arrival is a situation of a terrible living circumstance. The house is cold. The little children are clad, the littlest one, 2-year-old, in a filthy diaper, no shirt on. It is far too cold for him to be attired in that way. The 5-year-old, similarly, is not appropriately attired. The children are very thin, very, very malnourished looking. The 15-year-old Michael is asleep in his bedroom when the scene opens. The officers are now arriving on scene. I just want you to get your minds there. They are walking into this house, and they have a search warrant which has earlier been approved by a judge. So I will call on the officer who is going to begin his process. We have signs that we hope will assist.
Okay, this this kitchen's a mess, and this room's a pretty big mess, too. It looks like there's a teenager asleep during the bed. And we have some evidence here. What are you doing? It looks like it could be bad. We need to get this into evidence. Thank you. What's your name?
Michael,
you're being placed under arrest. We're going to be taken to the juvenile hall. I need to advise you of your rights. It's my duty to warn you before you make any statement that you have the right to remain absolutely silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to consult an attorney before making any statement. If you're without funds, you have the right to court appointed attorney at public expense. You have the right to have your attorney present when and if you do make any statement. You have the right to interrupt the conversation anytime, and anything you say must be really voluntarily said. You understand those rights? Okay. I need you to stand up. You're under arrest for possession of controlled substance. Hands behind your back, please.
I was going to throw the bag away. Why are you doing this?
Well, do you want to tell me what's in the bag?
No.
You want to tell me where you got the bag or where anything about the bag or where it came from? Yes. Not sure why it's in your room?
No.
Okay. I need you to wait with this other officer right over here.
All right, now Michael is being led away. He's beginning to nod off again, not surprisingly, and they need to continue to search the residence. They have found a room in the residence. It has a locked door on it, and they need to get inside that room.
Mrs. Lewis, we have a search warrant for this entire residence, and this room is locked up. You have a key to the room?
I don't have a key. I have a room.
You know, does your husband have it? Or?
No, I don't know.
Where is your husband?
I don't know. I think he's around here somewhere.
Okay, Mr. Lewis? Yeah, we have a search warrant for this entire residence. And have you got access to the back room? Do you have a key in that room?
Yeah.
Okay. Look at that key. All right,
he's now into that room. And he's beginning to find a large bag of what appears to be methamphetamine.
Okay, another officer, I need you to take this little substance into being placed in the evidence right away, and we've got a whole bunch of credit cards as well. And they don't say Sally or Michael Lewis. These are either fake names or stolen identification. You can take those in evidence too. Mr. Lewis, you're being taken into custody for possession of a controlled substance, identity theft, and child endangerment. Mr. Lewis, we're taking you on the same charges. Mr. Lewis, you can take your hands away from that.
No, you can't take us. What do we do? No. Oh, my God. What are we going to do? Oh.
Sally is distraught. She doesn't want her husband to be taken. She is now taking out her sensation of being invaded on the police officer. Michael also has to go into custody. The mom is also going to be going into custody. The officers are in the position now with this very distraught family of trying to make a decision about these little ones, because now you have a juvenile who is off to detention because he has what the officers believe is methamphetamine in his possession, but he is also a child for the purposes of the law. And then the little ones, the 5-year-old and the 2-year-old, have to go into some kind of care. The officers have grabbed a little bit of clothing for them, and they are now in the process with the DHS worker of trying to find a placement.
Mr. and Mrs. Lewis, your children will be taken into protective custody. We'll find a safe place for them to stay while you get your things straight down. Is there a relative who can care for your children? Well, there'll be a juvenile court hearing tomorrow for the children. We will arrange to have you transported there from jail so you may participate in finding for your children.
All right. Everyone now that is an adult, that is both of the parents, have been arrested and they are being taken off to jail. The 15-year-old is going to the juvenile detention facility, and the 2 little ones are going with DHS to see whether or not they can find a placement for these children while the courts sort out what will be happening with this family. The adults have to be arraigned within 36 hours if the district attorney's office makes a decision to charge the adults, that is, if they have sufficient evidence to bring the charges. The shelter hearing, on the other hand, to deal with the little ones, has to happen within 24 hours. Now, there are 2 aspects to juvenile court. There is the dependency side, which is where children whose circumstances endanger them are being addressed by the juvenile court, and there is the delinquency side, which is that side of the juvenile court which addresses the conduct of children. I mean, they are children, but they are accused to have or accused of engaging in conduct that would be otherwise a crime were they an adult. So you can see that there are 3 cases being generated. The delinquency proceeding to deal with Michael, the dependency proceeding to deal with Justin and Jason, and the adult criminal proceedings. We're going to be dealing with the adult criminal proceedings tomorrow, and today we'll spend dealing with the juvenile proceedings. These matters then will result in a number of proceedings in juvenile court, the first of which will be the dependency shelter hearing that happens almost immediately upon the children being taken into care. And so I'm now going to bring forth the judge, and this is Judge Kirsten Thompson. She is a circuit judge in Washington County.
There has been a vote. They have found a foster care placement for the children, and the caseworker has given the foster father information relating to the children's background and current needs, and she leaves him a packet of information and asks him to call if there are issues of concern. Tells him that the shelter care hearing is scheduled. I want to bring one thing to your attention, and it's important to understand that the adults have gone into custody, but they also have a right to be present and participate in decisions being made about their children's placement. Oftentimes, facilities are far away from one another, so there's a transport issue as well. All of this is happening simultaneously.
Okay. All right, it's now time for the dependency shelter hearing, and we're here for a shelter hearing in the matter of Justin Jason and Michael Lewis. Can the caseworker please tell me what brought the family here today?
Thank you, Your Honor. I provided you with a detailed report as well as the police report. The state is not filing charges, or the state has filed charges against Mr. Lewis, and he is still in jail. The state has not filed charges against Mrs. Lewis. She is released, and she is here today.
Okay. All right, I'm going to be appointing a lawyer for Justin and Jason, the two younger children, and a separate attorney for Michael, the older child. It's been determined that the mother and father are both eligible for court-appointed counsel, and I'll be appointing an attorney to represent each of them. I'll also be appointing a court-appointed special advocate to assist with the case, and the court-appointed special advocate is a volunteer who will be assisting the family.
All right, now at this point, the judge would need some information regarding the parents and other legal issues, because the judge is going to have to make difficult decisions, obviously, about what to do with everyone. The parents, if they are present, are certainly free to speak, and oftentimes they want to. It makes sense. On the other hand, they're facing criminal charges, and so they may, on the advice of their attorneys, make a decision not to speak at that moment if their statements could be used against them in the criminal proceedings. So we're now going to introduce you to the mother's attorney and the caseworker and the prosecutor.
Okay. I'd like to hear from mother's attorney at this time.
Your Honor, good morning. My client, Ms. Lewis, has received an eviction notice as a result of yesterday's incident. However, she would like the children returned to her. Ms. Lewis indicates that she and her children can't stay with her mother. If the court will not allow the return of the children to my client, she would like the children to be placed with her mother, who is here in court today as well.
Could I hear more from the caseworker, please?
Yes, Your Honor, we interviewed Ms. Lewis yesterday and the possibility of a relative placement. The mother reported that there was no relatives who could care for the children, so they were placed in foster care. The agency recommends that children remain in foster care. We were able to locate the maternal grandmother this morning, and we will be conducting a home study and a family meeting after the hearing to determine whether the children can be placed with her. We will be establishing with the supervised business of Ms. Lewis and the children at the DHS office.
What is the district attorney's position?
Your Honor, according to the criminal history, Ms. Lewis has been arrested for possession of a controlled substance charge, failure to appear, and running under the influence in the last 3 years. The father is currently in custody on charges of possession of a controlled substance, identity theft, theft in the first degree, and child endangerment. Your Honor, it's the state's position that the children were not safe in this home, and we urge the court to find that there is probable cause to believe that the condition of the family and home jeopardized the welfare of the children. And we ask the court to temporarily commit the children to the custody of the Department of Community Services.
Okay. Anything further?
No, Your Honor.
All right, I would find that the agency has made reasonable efforts in this case to prevent or eliminate the need for placement of the children. The children were at risk of harm, and there was nothing that the agency could have done prior to the taking of the children into custody during the course of the search warrant being exercised. The children will remain in foster care for now, but the agency needs to investigate relative placements and place the children with a relative if an appropriate resource is located. The case is set for a jurisdictional hearing in 60 days. The agency is to prepare a written service agreement and to implement the recommended visitation schedule as soon as possible. If the mother is willing to agree to a pre-jurisdiction drug and alcohol assessment and inpatient treatment that's recommended, and the younger children can certainly be placed with mom in treatment without further court order if appropriate. We'll be addressing Michael's circumstances in court later this afternoon, and we'll discuss placement options for him at that time.
All right, so just to recap, and if there, I think we have some time here, so maybe if you have a couple questions, that would be okay to ask right now. The situation is the children have gone before the juvenile judge, their issues immediately, because the court wants to make sure and the agency wants to make sure that a placement with a relative might not be an option. Presently, as you know, from this scenario, these children went into foster care. And they went into foster care because at the scene, the mom was asked, do you have a relative that could care for the children? And the answer was no. Now, the next day, the agency has learned that there may be a relative that is an appropriate resource, and that would be the grandfather. So in this particular case, they're going to give some time to that issue and just see whether or not that might be a resource available to the court. We're going along at a pretty good clip, so I just wanted to give you an opportunity. If you don't have a question right now, that's fine. If you think of something and you want to ask us, go ahead and write it down, because I find the interactive parts can be helpful too. So, anybody have a question?
Under these circumstances, are there any questions you may entertain us at this point?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Cortez.
Tina?
Thank you.
You better come up to the mic, so identify yourself.
Representative Tina Kotek, North Portland. Could you tell us the timeline from when the children removed to foster placement? Is it 24 hours to see the court? Okay.
Yes. 24 hours to get to the show. Okay. That's the first hearing. Yeah. And the juvenile delinquency, when someone is old enough to be facing a charge that could be an adulterer, also will be heard that same day. Madam Chair. Thank you. All right. Now, we're going to move into the part I just told you about, the delinquency court. This is later in the day. Michael, who was arrested, although he's 15, he is both a dependent, because he's a child still, and he is falling under what we call the delinquency side, because he has charged him. So we're going to bring him in for his detention hearing, because the decision has to be made. Do we keep him in detention, or do we release him? So the DA will again appear before the judge, and so will the child.
Okay, we're here in the matter of Michael Lewis. Michael, you're here before the court today because the state says that you were in possession of a controlled substance, a serious matter, and you're entitled to a court-appointed counsel who is with you. I'd like to hear from the district attorney at this time regarding any opening matters.
Your Honor, I am providing the attorney and review a copy of the petition.
Okay. Michael, have you had an opportunity to look at the petition?
Yes.
Okay, and do you want to have an attorney help you today?
Yes.
Okay, so the gentleman next to you has been appointed by the court to assist you with this case.
I'm going to get the attorney and help you.
All right. Now, Michael, you and your attorney have a copy of the petition, and then we have some next steps that will need to be addressed, including where you will be placed at this time. I'd like to hear from the state regarding that.
Your Honor, we are having the methamphetamine and the straw that was inside the baby checked for fingerprints. The evidence was that Michael was exhausted, was in an exhausted state at the time of the search, and his comments to the officers and the location of the drugs in the room indicated that the drugs were his. There's enough evidence for the court to find that there is probable cause in this matter, and you'd be asking the court to find probable cause. I do have some additional comments later on regarding release decisions.
Well, no, I'm not going to ask the court to release Michael due to lack of probable cause. In reviewing the police report, I understand that the officer did find some methamphetamine in Michael's room, but there is no evidence indicating that it was actually his.
In view of the comments from defense counsel and the state, I would find that there is probable cause to continue to investigate this case, and I would like to hear counsel address the issue of release if they wish to do so.
Well, Your Honor, when we look at ORS 419C145, it does require the court to release Michael to the least restrictive placement that will still assure his appearance at future court hearings. This is Michael's first charge in juvenile court, and he tells me that he does attend school regularly at OK High School. He also tells me that he has a job working part-time. Michael would like to return to his mother's care or to the home of his maternal grandmother, who is here in court. He says that he will return to court if released. That's not going to be an issue, and he will agree to abide by the court's release conditions. If the state does have concerns, the juvenile department could provide supervision during his release.
Okay. All right. What's the juvenile department's position?
Yes, Your Honor. Dave Bryan, I represent the juvenile department. I'm the juvenile court counselor. And the juvenile department is recommending that Michael be released once an appropriate foster care placement is located. We do believe he is at high risk for methamphetamine use, and the placement needs to be chosen very, very carefully. A relative placement is not an option until we know more about the family history and Michael's history of methamphetamine use. Michael does have two prior referrals to the juvenile department, and those were handled informally. We have a DHS worker here, and they're already started working on placement options. Thank you.
All right. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm requesting, or the state is requesting, that this youth be held. We have reason to believe that he's still coming down off of methamphetamine. The detention staff described his behavior as erratic during the last 24 hours, and we believe that he's still at risk for using methamphetamine.
And this is Michael's first charge, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, is Mother here today? Ma'am, is there anything you wanted to bring to my attention?
If you don't trust me, you can place him with his grandmother. She's willing to take him in. Michael's a student at the high school, and he's a good kid, Your Honor. So he has a return to regular teenage life.
Thank you, ma'am. Right. And the caseworker is working on the placement issues, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I'm going to be releasing Michael to the temporary custody of the Department of Human Services today, and I'm asking the agency to investigate possible placement with his grandmother or another relative. And I'd like to hear what progress, if any, DHS has made on relative placements at this time and other placement options. Next.
Your Honor, we will continue to investigate the grandparents' household. We have talked to the grandfather who's here, who will be here today. We're also looking at other options, and then we'll try to keep siblings together in place for his younger brother and siblings. Younger brothers.
All right, thank you. Michael, I will be releasing you to DHS temporary custody today. As conditions of your release, I'm ordering that you abide by the rules of the home in which you're living, that you attend school regularly, and that you maintain regular contact with your attorney and with the juvenile department. I'd like the juvenile department to provide Michael with some written rules of release, please, including the dates and times that he's to make contact with the juvenile department and his next court appearance. Thank you.
Things
will be happening
over the end.
Michael, he looks really shady, so I've been careful. He was just released to DHS, right? So where is he?
Great question. Anybody want to answer that from DHS? How do you go about finding a placement for Michael? Thank you for that question.
I'm certainly Kevin Jordan. I work for the Department of Human Services Foster Care Program. And at times, what we're trying to do in the very beginning is look for relative placements, if at all possible. And as we said, we've already started looking at grandparents' household to see if they could actually do that. Grandpa's in the back, very proud of the sign. Part of what we need to be also looking at, then, is
We do background checks on the relatives. We do a criminal records check. We do other child abuse checks and start investigating them further. In the meantime, before we can actually do that, maybe that we find a regular foster home that's already certified and trained to care for people until we can get the grandparents able to take the child in. Simultaneously, we've also got two other brothers that we've already placed somewhere, so if we can put them all in one place before we go to grandma, ideally. But given the age difference of a 2-year-old and a 6-year-old, 5-year-old, and then a 15-year-old that has some delinquency issues, the chances of actually placing them all together is going to be pretty slim in many ways trying to put them together.
Now, I understand the process I'm going through, but last night he was in detention, and tonight, let's say you haven't done the investigations yet, there isn't an appropriate foster home available for tonight. Where is he tonight?
He will be with us tonight. We are walking out of the courtroom with him. That might be physically in a foster home that we find in the community. In some of the larger communities, there might be a shelter-type program, meaning we might have a contract with a private agency that can take in young adults or young children this age. So they will still go to a family home in most of the communities in Oregon. There might be struggle about how do you find these families that can take care of kids like that. On a moment's notice. So he's going to be physically with us somewhere that night in a foster home or in a contracted service that we actually may have.
Okay, but I'll just go one step further on this, and I'll think it's my county. Okay, this is a kid from Glendale, and so he appears in court in Roseburg, which is where DHS is, which is where probably most of the foster homes are. Now, part of what he's supposed to do is attend school in Glendale, but you don't have an appropriate placement for him in Glendale. What do you do now? Is it on your people to make sure that you place him 30 miles away and you transport him every day to the things he's supposed to do, or how does that work?
Right. The least restrictive environment is a broad term. Least restrictive being with relatives, other known people to the child. So maybe we've already researched out, does this young person have any friends, other neighbors that could take him in? If not, then we are moving, the 30 miles and whatnot. We do have the requirement to keep the child in the same school whenever possible. Last legislative session passed a law that allowed a child, foster child, to maintain their same residency even though they move to another school district, and then holds the Department of Human Services accountable to provide that transportation right there.
There was a question in advance, Senator Wilson. Madam Chair, do you need us to come to the
microphone? I would appreciate it very much.
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
That's right. Thank you, Senator Gordley. Could you explain what the time limits are for conducting the family investigation? Are you following guidelines from statute or administrative rule?
Thank you. I think that the DHS representative may be better suited to deal with that.
Certainly when we're doing a child abuse investigation versus the relative assessments. Relative assessment, if we're trying to assess are they able to take this child in, is something we can do by administrative rules in a pretty short order. I mean, we could do background checks, the criminal and the child abuse checks. If we're looking at doing the assessment on the family, whether child abuse occurred or not, we are following statute. And Nancy, help me with a time frame on that.
On the diligent search?
No, on the actual CPS, we have 30 days to complete the full assessment, but that's the outside window of time. So it's done before that. Again, we have a court within 24 hours, and we best have as much information as possible at that point in time. We have a situation where a judge might actually set that hearing over until more information is gathered, but the outside rule we have at this point in time is within 30 days we need to complete our CPS, our Child Protective Service assessments.
I don't see any other hands up. Okay, great. Thank you, though, for those questions. Now, in the next few weeks, Michael is going to be consulting with the attorney who was appointed to represent him. And he is going to be discussing possible defenses, motions to suppress evidence, that was taken, that sort of thing. He will be having his meetings with his attorney. In the meanwhile, the juvenile department, and this ties into these questions, is conducting its own study to evaluate whether Michael can safely be placed with the grandparents or whether Michael can be returned to his family, and they need a lot of information with regard to that. There is, and it's important to recognize this, and I've said it, but I'm just going to say it too often, there's also the dependency part of Michael's situation. He is both charged with what would be a crime if he were an adult with an offense, and he is also dependent because he's only 15, and he is dependent upon his family and the community for his care and sustenance. And so Michael will have a court-appointed special advocate, a volunteer citizen, who will also work with him to interview people who know him best and know his situation so that the CASA, which is the abbreviation for that person, will be able to provide that information to the court. So in this particular case that we have, the caseworker has conducted a study of the grandparent home and has learned within a two-week period that the grandparent is an appropriate resource, and therefore all three kids are placed with the grandparents. Now we're going to move over to the delinquency slide, and this is here. Michael, as you know, just like an adult who is charged with an offense, can either do an admission, which in adult court would be called a plea of guilty, or he can dispute it, and he can demand a trial and have the prosecutor attempt to prove that the offense was committed. In this case, Michael has made a decision along with his attorney to enter into an admission. And so you're going to get to witness the discussion that preceded that between the DA, who has the case, and the defense attorney appointed to represent Michael as they discuss ways that they might reach resolution, which would be in the best interest of both sides. And you're going to hear them discuss the evidence that was actually seized. Remember, it was a baggie. It was seized at the residence. I think you got to see that. And Michael then went into police custody immediately after that. In this case, the DA has offered a plea to a lesser charge, misdemeanor possession of methamphetamine. And that's of interest, obviously, because it would assure Michael of avoiding a felony in his record. And so he's interested in that. And you're going to get to witness that take place. This is the prosecutor at the hearing during which the admission occurs.
We're here in the matter of Michael Lewis, and the youth is prepared to make an admission to one count of misdemeanor possession of a controlled substance.
Counsel, is your client ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor, he is. I have reviewed the plea petition. My client is confident, wants to proceed with admission, so today he's going to ask the court to accept an admission to the charge.
And I typically would have a young person stand at this point and review with him the petition to make admission. I'll just maybe shortly go through that process. Michael, if you'd stand, please. Have you reviewed the petition to make admission with your attorney? Okay. Do you realize that you could have said, no, I don't admit to this, and you would have a trial? Have you reviewed with your attorney the evidence the state would likely present?
Yes.
Okay. Has anybody offered you anything to accept this this plea? Okay. Has anybody threatened you with anything? And other than that they're allowing you to admit to a misdemeanor, is there anything else that's making you decide to admit that this is true?
No.
Okay. All right. And do you wish to admit today that you possessed methamphetamine? Okay. Thank you. I'll accept your admission. You can sit down. What's the state's recommendation?
The state recommends that the youth be placed on 18 months probation, that he submit to a drug and alcohol evaluation, participate in treatment, and perform community service. We're asking that the court order the standard general conditions of probation, that he obey all laws. And we urge the youth
to use the services of the probation department so as to conform his behavior and to choose a life wherein he does not use controlled substances. Should he violate his probation, the state would be seeking revocation of his probation. So we ask him to make better choices and not commit these crimes.
What's the juvenile department's recommendation?
Yes, Your Honor. I've taken some time to interview Michael and his family. I've gotten information from the school, and as you know, I've written a report that you have, Your Honor, and all parties have. And the juvenile department does agree with the DA's recommendations. I've also arranged a drug and alcohol evaluation for Michael, and that's scheduled for tomorrow.
Okay. All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Michael is in agreement with all the recommendations. By making this admission and agreeing to participate in drug and alcohol evaluation, he is accepting responsibility for his actions and has indicated that he intends to remain clean and sober. As this court knows, the family has had problems recently, but they are all working through their issues and are following through with all the recommended services. The issues for Michael are very different than for his younger siblings, and we would like at this point to ask the court to consider allowing Michael to return to the care of his mother.
The state's position?
Your Honor, it's my understanding that the dependency dispositional hearing will be held next week. I'd ask and request, Your Honor, to consider specific placement requests at that hearing once we have the drug and alcohol evaluation. Thank you.
Michael, I'm going to be following the recommendation of the state and the juvenile department. You are within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court based on admitting to possessing a controlled substance. You're also in the temporary care of the Department of Human Services. You're being placed on probation. You'll be under the supervision of the juvenile department, and I'll be hearing more about where you're going to be placed at the next hearing with your brothers. At this point, I'm going to leave the placement decision up to DHS until I hear more about that at the next hearing next week. Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to throw out a couple of discussion points. Maybe I can have somebody here answer it for me. There was a mention of the Oregon Youth Authority, and there was also a mention of the Juvenile Department and DHS. Ms. Eversay, you're a prosecutor, and I think you had indicated that you might be recommending his placement with the Oregon Youth Authority should he violate the conditions of his probation. Would you speak to what you meant when you said that?
Your Honor, the local probation department handles the execution and delivery of services regarding drug and alcohol treatment and probation services. But if a youth is unable to conform his behavior, then the state is likely to recommend that the probation be revoked and a sentence be imposed. And that could mean commitment to the McLaren house for commitment to McLaren and basically incarceration. So a more structured environment wherein that services could then be provided in a structured setting.
Thank you. And the juvenile court counselor serves in essence as a probation officer? Is that what you see?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Juvenile court counselor, and I work with Multnomah County, and in Multnomah County I think it's sometimes different from in other counties yet, where we can have Oregon Youth Authority involved when Multnomah County Juvenile Department is also involved. So in this case, the youth is temporarily committed to DHS, but sometimes if the youth is in need of long-term residential community placement without going to the correctional facility, the judge can order temporary commitment to the Oregon Youth Authority and then have a youth go to a placement in the community, a residential treatment program. Oregon Youth Authority could then be involved, plus the juvenile department at least in Multnomah County could also be involved and still do supervision at that time. A probation violation could happen at that point, and as it mentioned, and possibly the youth could then have their probation revoked and then go to the correctional facility. But hopefully we always try to prevent that.
All right, and let me ask you, Judge Thompson, you were being asked, as you heard by the child, through the child's attorney, Michael, was asking the court to go back to his mom
what made you decide that that might not be an optimum placement? And I should indicate under our fact scenario, the mother, although she was arrested on the night in question, was not ultimately charged yet in adult court. There wasn't, in the DA's opinion, sufficient evidence to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. So the mother was released back into the community. That's why the mother was right there in open court and kept talking about how Michael was a good kid and just needed to go home to mom. Why did you make the decision that you did not to put Michael back with his mother?
I think this is a fairly common scenario when a family has drug issues. And at this point, where where Michael has admitted to the delinquency behavior, we know for sure that Michael has a drug problem. The juvenile counselor has told me there's going to be a drug and alcohol evaluation, and he's on probation, so he's mandated to do services. I don't know what I've got there. And Mom, on the other hand, hasn't had her trial yet. And I don't have any information other than what occurred when she was taken into custody and the children were taken into shelter care. I don't have any information about whether or not she truly has a drug issue, whether or not it's just a circumstantial issue for her, and whether or not she would be able to be a safe placement for Michael and assist and supervise him and allow him to be successful on probation. So just not enough information yet.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions?
Yes, I am.
Representative Boone?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, where does the drug court fit in?
Representative Deborah Boone, House District 32. I just wondered where the drug court would fit in to this scenario.
I think I can maybe speak to that a little bit. Drug court is in most counties at this point, I think in all counties that have a drug court for adults, is limited to persons who have been convicted of a drug-related crime or other crimes that have lots of drug indications involved. So they're mandated as a condition of probation or maybe, probably probation, to complete drug and alcohol treatment. And they're within the specific jurisdiction of the court at a criminal proceeding. And so I know in Washington County have parents, and I think at this point so far it's primarily been mothers who have been participants in drug court who also have dependency cases going along. And that's a real successful partnership to get a parent to be held accountable and make their way through treatment successfully.
Thank you. What happened to Michael for that period of time that he's going to be on probation in terms of a wraparound service, drug and alcohol, making sure he's in school, look like some aberrant behavior because of, finding the drugs in the bed and that kind of stuff. So what happens to him in terms of that collective service?
Okay, great. Thank you for that. Who wants to feel that? You're with the Juvenile Court Services. You want to talk about the wraparound services that will be made available to Michael?
Sure. As a juvenile court counselor, I would work closely with the DHS worker and other parties, meet regularly with Michael, mother, grandparents, things like that. We do have the Multnomah County Family Care Coordinator that does wraparound services, who would talk about what sort of services that we can do to help support Michael. Go to the school, do school meetings, make sure Michael has all the services that he needs to be able to be successful. We have some money to go to flex funds to be able to try to see, does Michael need a tutor? Can we help get Michael a mentor, get him some other services so he can be able to stay drug-free? We'll do some UA things. Regular UAs, they'll meet with me on a regular basis. In Multnomah County, we do a GAIN, a global assessment of individual needs, where it's a comprehensive mental health, dual diagnosis of mental health and alcohol and drug screening or evaluation, so stay in close contact with a mental health, drug and alcohol person too.
Thank you. Excuse me, Senator
Thank you. To what extent are you funded, underfunded, overfunded to do your work? And I'm talking about the wraparound treatments. Do you have enough staffing? What's your waiting list?
Waiting list for getting kids into treatment?
Do you have enough staffing to deal with all of the cases that come before you?
Actually, our numbers in the last couple of years have been quite a bit lower than they were in the last few years. So we have enough support right now, but it's, you know, trying to juggle our caseload is always a challenge. But something that we need to do is make sure that there's enough funding for programs for kids to go to. One of the things that I struggle with on a daily basis is getting community placements for kids, residential placements. I work in a program that has kids in a secure treatment program that happens to be located in our detention. But one of the conflicts there is once kids can complete that program, there's just not enough services to be able to have a less secure but highly structured program for those kids to go into. There are limited resources, I know, for the state, for OYA, and for kids to be able to have placements other than that.
Follow-up, Senator Morrison.
Yes, follow-up. Thank you. I understand that county funding may be cut because of timber receipts and so on, and I know a lot of counties are currently doing their budgets, and I'm just wondering if what you see on the horizon are our programs going to suffer significantly because of lack of funding.
I think he's smiling, Senator, because he's from Multnomah County. He's not a policy person from parole and probation. Mr. Cook, do you want to take a stab at that?
Be happy to.
Thank you.
I'm David Cook from Multnomah County. David Cook, Multnomah County Department of Community Justice and Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association. Senator Moore said you're absolutely right. Those counties that receive timber revenues are certainly in a position where I know in talking to my colleagues that the kind of services and funds that they typically had available in their juvenile departments are going to be reduced substantially. And that's a significant concern for those jurisdictions. I think what you see perhaps is with the Oregon Youth Authority budget and the State Commission on Children and Families budgets that there'll be some supports available, but it's not going to be sufficient to make up for what those counties will experience in terms of cuts.
I think so. And legislators, just a reminder that counties have already started coming in, talking to our Committee on Human Services regarding that gap and that funding cut that they're going to be experiencing. So there will be some deliberative processes that take place between the state and counties on this particular issue. And as you know, we are looking at situations that are not as bright as we'd like for them to be at all. So, Representative Flores, and then Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge Maurer, early on in the scenario, the DA had pled Michael from a felony to a misdemeanor. Is that done often, and by what authority does a DA do that?
In my experience, the entry into plea bargains is a very common practice, both, I think, at the juvenile level and also at the adult level. And there are myriad reasons for that. Typically, my experience is that the prosecutors have an interest in assuring themselves of a conviction, if you will. It's a juvenile court, so we don't call it a conviction. On the adult side, we call it a conviction. They have the assurance of having the conviction. A trial, of course, may result in a jury or in juvenile court, as we are here today, a judge finding that there is insufficient evidence. And then there is no ability to intercede and effectuate the changes that the state has an interest in effectuating and holding people accountable if there is an acquittal. So the state will weigh, typically, whether the state believes it can prove its case by the applicable standard, proof beyond reasonable doubt. Now, for the juvenile or the adult that is facing the decision, do I have a trial or do I have a plea bargain, they too are weighing those options. If the person who is facing the accusation is weighing how likely is it that the state will be able to prove the case, and if the state can prove the case, what are the chances that I, as the accused, will be able to achieve the result that I would like, which is perhaps to have some treatment and be on probation and to prove myself.
So those are the conflicting goals, if you will, and the reasons that people often come to yes when it comes to settlement of a case. Also, typically, in my experience, if the prosecutor goes forward and the felony is the charge that they proceed upon, the trial itself has implications for the family. The parents oftentimes will go first in a juvenile court proceeding. The families can be torn apart during that process, which isn't necessarily a reason to forego it. It's just one factor that people will rely on in making a decision whether or not to go forth. And it's particularly true, for example, if Michael were going to say, it's not my methamphetamine, it's my dad's. And then that then has implications for that entire family at a later time. So there are a lot of different factors, and in fact, I think it's helpful for a prosecutor to be able to regularly do this to take up that topic. And I'm happy to meet you, Ms. Eberzay, if you would like to undertake that.
Well, I think the only thing I would add is that, first of all, I didn't negotiate the case, and I want to be clear that a case has to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis, and there are myriad factors that prosecutors can consider. And I think it's best described as prosecutorial discretion, in that you apply your discretion to the facts of a particular case and determine whether or not you have sufficient evidence to prove the case, and whether there is an adequate, if there are mitigating or other factors that would dictate an appropriate outcome is a lesser charge. So I think prosecutorial discretion is something that is something that you would expect prosecutors to exercise in each case.
And part of my job would be to make sure that there are facts, perhaps inside the family, that she wouldn't be aware of. She wouldn't know the family, that there are facts that could be brought to light that would maybe help her to realize this would be a good case to us to use her discretion. So.
Representative
Nathanson, Judge. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13, North Eugene. My interests are in seeing a whole family get well. It's my belief that if individuals are continuing to be exposed to unfortunate situations, then even though they may get well temporarily, they may not be able to get well permanently. So in thinking about protecting the rights of the individuals through the legal system, I also get concerned about how our social structure, how our agencies can treat a whole family as well as individuals. So, for example, in the scenario, we heard that the house was cold. There are two younger children. I haven't heard yet about what's happening with these younger children who have been exposed to seeing adults as well as a teenager in behaviors that we wouldn't want modeled. So what's being done for those younger children in the meantime, and how do we help treat a whole family rather than just parts of it?
Could not have asked that question at a better time, because the next scenario actually is the lead into that very issue, which is the role of the courts in the dependency proceedings. This is how to address the needs of the entire family. One thing I should indicate is the goal is always to return children as possible to their families, because of the information that we have that they function best if the families can be made whole. And that's exactly what you were addressing. So the next scenario is the dependency jurisdictional dispositional hearing. And this is where the judge is going to be talking to all of the people that are affected and trying to decide how we're going to address this family situation. And I should indicate that in this scenario, just to move things forward, we did not have you go through the process of a trial of the parents on the dependency side. They, too, have decided that they will make admissions about the home environment that they were failing to provide to their children. And so the parents now have gone forward in a way that will make them subject to the court's jurisdiction. So I'll turn it over to the judge.
Now that I've received admissions from the parents and I've heard some of the early comments regarding the case, I'd like to move on to the disposition of this case. What is the agency recommending?
Your Honor, we'd like mothers to undergo a drug and alcohol evaluation and any recommended treatment. Plus, we'd ask that she attend parenting classes. She needs to obtain stable housing, consider lighting,
I'd like to hear from Mother's Counsel at this time.
Thank you, Anna. We agree with all of the recommendations. We have just one thing that we would like to address with the court. My client would like to be able to address her substance abuse issues through Narcotics Anonymous. She has already started attending Narcotics Anonymous and does not want to disrupt her progress by switching to a different treatment plan.
Okay, and Father's Counsel?
We agree with those recommendations, Your Honor.
Okay. What's the position of the children's attorney?
Well, Your Honor, we agree with DHS's recommended services and also Justin's been having some behavioral difficulties at home, so we would recommend that DHS arrange an assessment to determine whether he needs some early intervention services. We do not agree with the idea of letting Ms. Lewis address her treatment needs through Narcotics Anonymous. That is an outpatient program. The level of her problem indicated by her evaluation is that that's not a sufficient level of supervision and treatment. So we would not be in agreement with that. She needs a more intensive kind of treatment. She wants to get her kids back.
What report, if any, do we have from the court-appointed special advocate?
Your Honor, you have received our detailed report, but in summary, I've met with all three children in the maternal grandparents' home, and they are doing pretty well overall. Justin is acting out, and I support the attorney's recommendation for assessment. Michael is being very helpful with his younger brothers, even though he is anxious to go home. The grandparents are holding this family together, and they could use some respite as well as counseling to support their health and the children through the trauma. I recommend that the children remain in the grandparents' home and that DHS continue to offer services to the mother so the children can be returned home. I support the recommendation for formal treatment for the mother in addition to her engagement at NA.
And what is Michael's position?
Thank you, Your Honor. Michael is doing well at his grandmother's home, but he is today requesting to be able to return to his mother's care. As I said last time, we heard Michael's needs are significantly different than those of his younger siblings. He can get himself to school and and complete his probation requirements while in his mother's care. And he has the added support and oversight of the juvenile department, so we'd ask that he return to his mother's care today.
Okay. Anything further from the state?
No, the state supports the recommendations of the Department of Human Services.
Well, with respect to this case, the court does find that the children are within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court and orders continued custody to the Department of Human Services with recommended services to be offered to mother. The court orders the agency to develop a service agreement with the children's father and to provide Ms. Lewis with a list of formal drug treatment services that would meet her level of need. I really hope that Ms. Lewis chooses to engage in a treatment program in addition to Narcotics Anonymous. Continue the other services as outlined in the service agreement, and we should be evaluating whether visits can be supervised by the grandmother if mother continues to stay clean and sober for 30 days based on random drug testing.
Right. So some of the issues now that I think you probably observed that should be highlighted, I think, is that it's not uncommon, for example, for the teenager to want to be home with his mom, and his mom wants to have the teenager home. On the other hand, other people who have looked into the matter think maybe mom needs some time out. She needs to be in treatment before he is returned. How do you make those decisions?
The scenario presented in this case is really a familiar one, where mother is engaged in a really excellent self-help 12-step group that is totally run by the participants of the group. It doesn't have any reporting capability to the court or anybody else, and does not provide random drug testing. So for mom to choose that may be excellent, but if it's just an adjunct to other treatment, that's wonderful. But if it's the only thing she's doing, it's really concerning. And that would be one of the factors that would lead into the court not being able to consider placement of the 15-year-old with mom.
Okay, and let's talk about how, and maybe somebody from juvenile can answer this, but how do we ensure that the parents are getting to visit with their children? In other words, the children have all been placed with the grandmother, which is an excellent placement, or the grandfather in this case, and it's an excellent placement, but we want to make sure that there are visits if possible. Did you contemplate that there would be some visits, and how would you want to be sure that those were monitored?
Well, the agency is to be providing visits and creating a specific visitation plan, and something not less than once a week is what's anticipated. One of the comments that the court was making in this is that as soon as it's possible, maybe grandmother could supervise the visits, and I'm sure the DHS can speak to visitation resources better than I.
Certainly, visitation resources, it's extremely important for kids in foster care to continue visiting their parents. We try to really look at a prioritization of the level of safety and security for these kids. So it may be that visits are supervised in our office, in a visitation room, all the way to visiting happening in grandma's home, supervised by grandma, or not supervised at all. Once mom has demonstrated enough treatment and made for enough progress along, she may start having visits before the kids go back home without anybody supervising. So it's really a graduated visitation plan of what is the needs for that child to keep them safe. What is the need for mom to not only have a visit, but even to assess some of her parenting knowledge, skills, and abilities during that time?
Judge Geeks, you can just remind Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure who could answer this best, but how likely is it that the mother could get that intensive drug and alcohol treatment if she lived outside of a metropolitan area?
Okay, great. Go ahead and stand up and keep it with that.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Getting treatment outside of the metropolitan area, like Portland and the I-5 corridor, there are just not enough treatment beds for moms to get the treatment they need if they are not pregnant and if they are not currently using IV use. So it's difficult.
Thank you.
Representative Flores?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In this scenario, the father's still in jail, correct?
Correct.
And it seems to me I heard the judge say that the service agreement you did make one with the children's father. So what's his role, and is the first point on that step checklist, which I, as I understand it, the service agreement, these are the things that you must do in order to reestablish a relationship with your family. The first one would be get out of jail free.
Yes, I mean, the first thing that will have to happen, and it's a difficult issue because the father is in custody and may well be going on to a state institution. Whichever one of you deals regularly with the dads in that situation or any parent in that situation, I'd kind of throw that open to anybody who wants to take a stab at that.
Well, certainly, we're required, and obviously the judge orders it, to develop service agreements for both parents. And we have got to continue, including dad, and all this updating should be updating about dad's progress on each and every court hearing, regardless whether dad's in jail or not. It may actually include that dad has some level of contact with the kids, maybe he's sending letters to them. By the time dad actually goes to prison, maybe he's gone for a long time, there may be some level of regular contact kids have, depends on really the relationship with him and the children and what we're trying to establish. But there is an expectation that as soon as dad gets out, he has to have services in place, places to live, what kind of contact he's going to have with the kids or with the mom for that matter as well.
One aspect, if I may, regarding that is at least in Washington County, and I think most counties, there would be provision for the father to appear telephonically at these hearings, even if he was incarcerated, you know, at one of the institutions around the state, and certainly in a local kind of a setting, he would be brought over, again, at least in Washington County, he would be brought over to appear at all of the children's dependency hearings personally so that he would be informed about what was going on. And there would be an expectation that the father would continually be informed, even if he's in custody, so that when he's out of custody and has his criminal matters resolved, he can present himself, you know, as a physical custodian for the children if possible. But in the meantime, he can be writing letters or making phone calls or whatever is appropriate. In this case, one of the charges was child endangerment, so he might not be able to have contact with the children because of those kinds of charges, at least for a while.
Further question. Thank you, Madam Chair. In regard to the court-appointed special advocate and the lawyer for the two-year-old, how do those functions differ, or are they somewhat the same for a younger child vis-a-vis an older child?
Thank you for that. That's a great question. What's your experience in the court, or whoever is here for PASA, you can talk about that, too.
Well, I'll speak a little bit for CASA. CASAs are volunteers, and they don't represent anybody. They represent the best interest of the family as a whole. The children's attorney, depending upon the age of the child, and you know, for example, Michael's attorney is representing a 15-year-old. That 15-year-old has positions, has things that he definitely wants his attorney to say and advocate for him. Younger children may or may not say what they want. CASA is going to look at the entire family and report to the court about everybody, mom, dad, the kids, grandma, grandpa, caseworker, the whole works. Because as a volunteer, they have access to everybody, they have party status. And CASAs, I would note, this is a fortunate case to have a CASA at this early stage of the case. Not every case is going to be able to have a CASA because we have a limited number of CASA volunteers. And so this would be a case that would be likely to have a CASA appointed, if possible.
Senator Wesley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to piggyback a little bit on Chair Shields' comments about adequacy of access outside of the metropolitan areas. And the last thing I am saying is that funding for services in Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas County is adequate. It is not. But if it is inadequate in the metropolitan tri-county area, it is egregiously underfunded in rapidly growing rural areas of the state, specifically Central Oregon, and I know I speak for Senator Bates and Representative Buckley when I say the Southern Oregon area. What is also missing in this discussion is the value of wraparound mental health services, because so many of these substance abusers are self-medicating, and that starts the downward spiral. You know, we've got to see this holistically, and it has got the departments, the agencies, and those that work so hard have got to have the resources and the tools to be able to address this growing and critical need in all of our communities. Thank you, Madam Chair.
One of the things that we're going to be looking at for sure, and I know in the Human Services Committee, Judge, and that is the ratio between caseworkers and the numbers of cases that they do have, which has really crippled us across the state. One of the other things, too, is looking at the numbers of beds in terms of addiction and in the mental health community. So we're having to look very closely at our whole system of human services in the state in order to become a little more effective, because there will be a study coming out pretty soon that all of you will have access to show that we are a little short in the state on, number one, the ratio between caseworkers and the numbers of cases they have, and also addiction beds.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
For one second.
I wanted to relate to what Representative Shields said. I'm not Senator Westman said. I'm Timothy Travis. I work for the courts. One of my portfolios is to support and encourage the treatment courts around the state. And as the good senator said, upwards of 60% of the people who we find have drug addiction problems or also have mental health problems. And one of the things that we're doing is trying to get the mental health people together with the substance abuse people and to provide joint treatment at the same time. The other thing I want to say, and I want to say it very clearly, is if this mother had OHP coverage, she would not have problems finding inpatient drug treatment. One of the big problems that we're facing in Oregon, everywhere, rural, urban, doesn't matter where, is that we don't have funds to provide treatment, substance abuse treatment, for people who are addicted to drugs. Because of the budget crisis over the past few years, we have literally returned money to the federal government that we could have had for drug treatment in Oregon, but Oregon could not afford to fund its own treatment at a level such to meet the match. Our drug treatment system in Oregon has been decimated over the past 6 years. We have lost hundreds of therapists, a lot of treatment, and we absolutely have to look at putting that system back together, because we have parents who are losing their children because they can't get drug treatment. And they don't have OHP, they don't have any way to pay for it, and the line goes out the door and around the block.
Excuse me, Judge, for 1 minute. Representative Shields.
Just real briefly, I just want to also make the point that, you know, treatment itself, the therapeutic intervention, isn't necessarily like a pill that you can give and you can therefore cure somebody. While the treatment is, you know, part of why people get clean and sober, it's really living the recovery lifestyle and having the resources in your own community. I mean, for somebody from Roseburg to go do treatment in Multnomah County and then go back to Roseburg where there aren't outpatient if they happen to stumble and don't need to go all the way back into inpatient again. There needs to be some type of support services in their own particular community, not just going for treatment somewhere else.
I agree with that. We have two more scenarios, so I'm going to move into the Citizens Review Board piece of this presentation. This is, for the purposes of our fact situation, 6 months after the police were first at the home of this family. So the children have been living with their grandmother or grandfather for the last 6 months. And now the family is appearing before the Citizens Review Board. This is a group of community volunteers, and they are appointed by the Chief Justice. The purpose of the CRB is to provide an objective third-party review of this case and to make recommendations that will achieve the goals that everyone is talking about, which is to achieve a successful permanent outcome for the children and to advocate for improvements in the foster care system as a whole. So all of the kids that are in foster care have to be reviewed every 6 months, and now you're getting a chance to see how that happens.
Good morning. We are here today to review the case of Justin Johnson and Michael Lewis. We want to give every participant an opportunity to talk tonight. Particularly, we're interested in learning what is being done to accomplish the plan for a safe and permanent outcome for the children. So, Mr. Caseworker, can you tell us a little bit
Kevin Jordan on behalf of the Department of Human Services. Mr. Lewis is not a currently engaged in services that have been offered due to his incarceration. Much like that, he has been able to access treatment through a free community organization, and though she's providing clean new aid, the treatment progress is not the level we'd like to see. We're still hoping to find a more formal treatment program for Mr. Lewis. The children are doing well. Grandmother's home. The mother is also attending parenting classes, and this is going well.
Okay, can we hear from the CASA, please?
I continue to visit the children. All three of them are doing well.
That's very cool.
They've been having good interactions with friends, and Michael's been stable in school.
I would like to see them remain with the grandparents until the mother becomes more stable. Her visits are easier at grandparents' homes than they were prior to that, but once a week is barely enough for either the children or for her. And Michael does need his own visits with her. He's still anxious to go home, and he doesn't always see how important his presence is to his grandparents and to his brothers. All three children asked about their father. Mom does seem to be making some progress, but she still needs an ongoing formal treatment for him.
Thank you. Mrs. Willis, are your attorney? Can you tell us what you'd like to tell us?
Well, we're really pleased that Mrs. Willis is doing so well. She would like the agency's help, though, in finding some stable housing. That, toward the end, that her children could be returned to her care. And one possibility would be that Ms. Willis move in with the grandparents who are taking care of the children. Ms. Willis has been giving clean, random urinalysis and would be willing to give them more frequently, if necessary, so that she could reside with her mother and the children. She's willing to engage in a more structured treatment program, but only if one becomes available, since we've been trying to find one. She's also having difficulty meeting the cost of the treatment program.
Thank you. Can we hear from Mr. Lewis's attorney?
Yes, as you know, Mr. Lewis is still in custody, so he is unable to be a custodial resource at this time, but is pleased with his wife's progress. And does support the plan to return the children to their mother's care.
Great. Can we hear from the attorney representing the two younger children?
The grandfather is doing a wonderful job with the kids, and we support the placement with the grandfather. He is kind of being stretched financially by taking care of these children. More income, and so we are hoping that the agency will be able to provide some support for him in terms of clothing, vouchers, and some other kinds of economic support. But we are very pleased with the grandfather, and we're pleased with the mother's progress.
We're about 6 months. Michael's been out of home in sub-care, and we think it's time Michael returned to his mother. His needs are significantly different than those of his younger brothers. Michael was attending school regularly and we'd like you to recommend that, but if a return is not possible, we are still requesting that community visits start taking place with Michael. He's now having weekly visits at grandmother's home, and they're difficult for him because his siblings require significant attention, and they tend to dominate his mother's attention during her visits. So we request community visits for Michael. We did the last family decision meeting. They still haven't started yet. And we asked the board to make a recommendation of course that he begin visits in the community as soon as possible.
Thank you. Well, in conclusion, the board supports the placement, the current placement for all three children with the grandparents. But we'd like to look at the community visits for Michael so long as Mrs. Lewis's urinalysis has remained clean. We support the recommendation for clothing vouchers, but we would like to recommend in terms of further things that DHS do the service agreement with the father as was ordered by the court, that we continue to look at the more formal treatment program from this list has been recommended, including funding, and perhaps even look at ways to help the kids communicate with their dad a little bit at the cost of the working number. And lastly, we would want to make sure that there's concurrent planning done for the children in the event that Ms. Lewis isn't successful in getting another permanent plan for the children. And last, I guess I would just say, it's a system issue. The board is a little concerned that we're 6 months into this case and we still haven't got the formal treatment that everybody seems to think is necessary.
All right, now we're going to move to the final scenario. This is the dependency permanency hearing because decisions have to be made. This ties into that last statement, 6 months and a half. And in this case, there is some good news. The mother has achieved some treatment successes, but she's had some relapses, not uncommon. So there is some concern that the mother needs to get into inpatient treatment to address her needs because outpatient hasn't been completely successful. So they are now recommending inpatient treatment, and we're in front of the judge at the permanency hearing.
Okay. Have all the parties here for the permanency hearing? And maybe before we begin this part of the hearing, a permanency hearing is required in every dependency case. The earlier of 12 months from jurisdiction or 14 months from the time that the children were removed from parental care. So we're at somewhere in that timeline, probably at 12 months. So now is the time for the permanency hearing for Justin, Jason, and Michael Lewis. What is the agency's plan for the children?
Your Honor, we've had little contact with Mr. Lewis and no services at this point in time. We plan to continue offering services to the mother until she can have the children returned to her care. She did have significant home time with only 2 relapses and has completed the other court order services. She will be entering an inpatient treatment program next week. Our goal is for the children to be able to join her in the program within 60 days.
And what is Mother's Counsel's position?
Your Honor, we agree with that.
Okay, and Father's Attorney?
Thank you, Your Honor. My client has been released from jail and is on probation. However, he is not present in court today. When he last contacted me, he wanted the children to be permanently placed with the mother.
And children's attorney for the younger 2 children?
Your Honor, we cannot agree with this continuing services for the mother. The children have been in care for 12 months. These are young children who run the risk of reactive attachment disorder and all kinds of risks that the court is very well aware of. The children don't have permanency in a timely fashion. The mother has relapsed twice now. We're 12 months in, and now we're looking at another 12-month treatment program with no assurance that she will succeed. We are urging the court to adopt an alternative plan, some kind of a guardianship or something, so that we can get these children where they know they will grow up and we can move on.
What's Michael's position in this?
You know, we would like the plan to remain return to parent, in this case the mother. Michael is 15 years old and continues to request that he be returned to his mother's care as soon as she finds some stable housing. Michael himself has successfully completed probation and is doing everything he can to earn the court's trust and confidence that he will make the right choices for himself in the future, regardless of where he is placed.
They have from the CASA at this time?
Yeah, Jason, Justin, and Michael have the stability of their grandparents' love and care and have been able to maintain their bond with their mother and to a lesser degree with their father. Their sense of future and their fear of what might happen hangs in limbo, and their need for permanency is paramount. I believe the plan needs to be changed to guardianship or adoption by the maternal grandparents. This doesn't preclude other living arrangements in the future and supports the really important bonds that they have with their parents, but gives the children and the grandparents the assurance that the trauma of losing their home won't happen again.
I'm happy that we've got the grandfather here today. Sir, is there anything you'd like to let me know?
Yes, Your Honor. I appreciate you having me here today. And the children love their grandmother. They don't like the chance to live with their grandmother. Mom, and have the kids return, give her a chance. Of course, we can only take care of the children that have them in our home, but we'll continue to have that. They'll always be welcome to our home, and we could always have mom and dad in the house, too. But, you know, we'd like to keep our days going to treatment. We'd like to give them the opportunity to finish that treatment, and it allows the kids to go home. They really love and miss their mom.
Thank you. Well, unfortunately, this case, has been a delay in formal treatment. Now, Mom is ready to engage in some formal treatment at this time, so I'm going to go ahead and continue this permanency hearing for a month's time in order to determine whether or not Ms. Lewis gets into the inpatient treatment that I believe she does need and to hear the opinions of the inpatient treatment providers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
portion. I'd like to talk, though, a little bit about a couple of issues, and I'd like to address them to you if I could, Judge Thompson. You know, what we heard here, I think, is not uncommon. We heard the children's attorney take a very forceful position advocating for a permanency plan of some kind, and maybe that should be adoption by the grandmother. And on the other hand, we heard the grandfather and the grandmother articulating their belief that we should take a wait-and-see attitude because they would like their children to stay with their own daughter, the mother of the children. What are the kinds of issues that you're going to want to consider when you next see this family in a month?
There are a couple of things that are woven into this story that are really typical that have driven the story. At the very first hearing, at the shelter care hearing, the judge made the comment that mom could go into a treatment facility with one of the children prior to the next hearing if she chose to do so. And that really relates to one of the issues that Timothy Travis brought up, which is availability for treatment. If you have a child in your care, then you're on OHP, then you can get inpatient drug treatment. And so often the best way for a parent to get treatment, also to get parenting education, is to go with a child or maybe a couple of children in some cases into an inpatient treatment facility. Unfortunately, in this case, like many cases, the parent didn't choose to do that. And she has done as is common, she's kind of gone along and she's had a couple of relapses. And at this point, it's pretty clear that the children are in different kind of situations. We've got a 2-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 15-year-old, actually probably by now a 3, 6, and 16-year-old. Clearly the 16-year-old wants to be with his mother and has wanted to be with his mother all along. And that 16-year-old is not going to be a good candidate for something like adoption. And it's questionable at a year's time how the younger children are going to cope with anything other than returning to a parent. In a month's time, when this kind of a case comes back before the juvenile court, what the judge is going to be looking for is a report from a treatment provider that says what really is the level of treatment that this mother needs in order to be successful. If she engages at this point, this is the kind of case where if she's engaged and her treatment level is reasonable, it may well be a case that we could see reunification. If she relapses again or doesn't engage in treatment, we've got the Adoption and Safe Families Act, which is federal legislation, also our own permanency guidelines built into the dependency statutes, which say that the judge has to make a decision. Can we continue a plan of return to parent, or do we need to look for a different permanent plan? And with children of these ages, we probably would be looking at a plan of termination of parental rights and adoption, because that is the most permanent alternate plan. And you know, this is the kind of case that could clearly go either way. Your Honor?
Yes.
And thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, Linda, Colonel.
Both Your Honors. thank you. It seems to me that we heard that at 6 months the mother had clean UAs. And at that point, why was she not considered, or what was it that was making her not be considered as meeting a minimally adequate standard of care for her children? And then she was doing everything that was asked up to that point, and as I understand it anecdotally, that these long-term processes oftentimes do result in dirty UAs coming back in when there seems to be no end in sight for parents in getting their children back with them. So,
right. Thank you for that. I think you put your finger right on the issue that the court struggled with. Why don't you take that? In other words, have a mother that arguably has been clean for a while, it's looking pretty good, but they're a little bit worried because the description of the home when the police first went there was so appalling that you're worried about putting the children back in that. So just weigh all of that.
Judge, can you, in taking that in consideration, another committee has to meet in here. So if you could limit your answer, and Colonel, if you're in a hurry, can you just ask her so they can answer it all at one time? And may I remind everybody that we have an 8:30 meeting in here tomorrow, and those members of the Human Services Subcommittee, you have 8:30 in the morning, but as well as 1 o'clock for our regular committee tomorrow as well. So just a reminder. Colonel, will you ask a question in relation
to Madam Chair. I have three quick points. Judge Thomas, the Honeyway, if you had a difference of agreement between DHS and CASA, do you give one more weight than the other? I have an experience issue in my district right now about that. Second, is it normal for the grandparent to be and to be able to testify at a decision on where to put the child? And third, is 24 months, not, is that too long to make a decision on the, where you place the child? Thank you.
Okay. Well, I'll try and answer those, I think, in reverse order. 24 months is too long. We should, you know, ideally, we should be making decisions more quickly than that. Unfortunately, the reality is it takes longer in many, many cases. It's heartbreaking sometimes how long children wait for a final decision. In terms of the how you weigh the CASA versus the caseworker, in most cases that I've had the privilege of having a CASA as well as a caseworker, the CASA and the caseworker generally have a cooperative relationship, and I don't see a lot of conflict between their recommendations very often. Anytime where you have conflicting recommendations between a CASA and a caseworker, it really makes your ears perk up and you pay a lot of attention and try and figure out why. And, you know, in those circumstances, you know, a judge's job is to listen to all the evidence and try and weigh the evidence and make a decision at that point, and that can be real tricky. Sometimes there's you know, these are personality-driven things sometimes, and so you don't weigh one heavier than the other. You just try and figure out who makes the most sense and has the most facts behind their arguments at that point. And in terms of the relapse issues, the difficulty with any kind of drug or alcohol issue is that relapse is often part of recovery. As a juvenile court judge, however, you get to a point where, listen, if all you're doing is relapsing, you're not in recovery. And I'm not going to give you a three-year-old to take care of if you're busily using methamphetamines. It's just not safe. And that's where, in this scenario, the mother having not been in formal treatment means that the juvenile court, the caseworker, and everybody else has a lack of really good, reliable information about, you know, how is mom actually doing? Is she, on the whole, understanding her drug process? Is she in recovery? Has she made the mental connections between what her behavior and circumstances were, and is she going to be able to sustain recovery? And I think the representative who mentioned that, that's the thing. Can you sustain your recovery in your community and keep sober and keep your children safe? And that's the hard call.
One last thing. I wanted to let people know that Public Safety Sub will be meeting in H-170 at 3 o'clock. And real briefly, some of you know I worked with people who are in recovery from addiction. And, you know, I wanted to just briefly mention that Faces of Meth picture that's up there.
Mm-hmm.
I know that picture is in the public domain. I know that it's used with the best of intentions, and it probably does some public good to show that contrast. But I'd hope we'll just remember that those are real people with real dignity, and we should respect that humanity. Thanks.
I appreciate so much seeing this played out today, and I hope that people will not just see it as role-playing, but seeing all of our people representing different agencies and institutions here today being real-life stories and incidences that the judges and the attorneys and the CASA people, the CRB, everybody is dealing with, and to know how complicated our system is and why it's important for all of us in government across the state to be working very hard with and collaborating with and realizing that we're all in this together. So thank you very much for your presentation today, judges, very much, and thank you for the committee and final thing from the judge before we leave?
No, we're just going to do the adult side tomorrow. Okay. What happens with the parents, and it's really been a privilege to be here.
Great. Expect to see everybody 8:30 in the morning. Thank you.